Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, how are we doing? Today is another great day. Jordan has a beautiful paisley shirt on. How many colours are involved in this?
See, this was given to me by a friend who's a female. She said to me, this doesn't suit me, maybe it'll suit you. And I was like, I'm not going to turn up free clothes, am I? So,
well, she's not wrong. But moving on, are you excited about today?
Well, today's I think we're getting to a big boys. We're getting to the big league. We got Mr. Richard Corrigan, for God's sake.
Oh, the big C.
The big C. It's a beautiful spring day in Mayfair. Every time we come down here, we just feel rich, don't we, pal?
I think that's the coffee. You've had about three in you.
Well, £3.50 for a coffee, Christ almighty.
Right, let's get off. Let's tuck ourselves in. Let's get on in there.
Guys, can we have utter silence? Kitchen door closed, yeah, and the Lindsay room door, please, yeah, and I don't want to hear one drop of a pen, yeah? Thank you. Could you get all the doors closed straight away now?
So, how's things been going then?
Very good. Very good.
I was just telling Jordan I was lucky enough to come for your St. Patrick's Day celebrations.
That's a party.
Yeah.
when did you decide, like, to start doing this as a regular thing? Because most people are quite busy, aren't they, doing your stuff?
Yeah, so, like, you know, it's very hard to get people in the hospitality business together, in fairness. Do you know what? Over the years, I've always been involved in the St. Patrick's thing, you know what I mean? I was on the Ken Livingstone's committee for the first St. Patrick's parade in London. And I have lots of stories about that, you know what I mean? Really, Trafalgar Square being part of kind of Westminster at the time and the mayor's office not having access to it. And so I was involved in all of that kind of groundwork stuff. I'm a trustee of a charity here in London with the Irish Youth Foundation, you know, which historically, you know, New Horizons and King's Cross and a woman's shelter in South London. And they were always kind of very Irish orientated. Now they're kind of, you know, Asian orientated and ex-military orientated. So it's quite interesting. You know, I've been in London 30 years floating around and I'm the right guy to throw a party. I think everyone will agree with that.
That's what I've heard.
I have a very strong constitution and nothing to be proud of because I'm now 56. I can look back and say, God, I survived that. I mean, I really caned it, guys. You
know? This is what I'm talking. We've got an hour to talk about you caning it. It's like, that could be it. Corrigan's cane.
Music, you know, from the early years of the Mean Fiddler and Divine up in Harlesden. You know what I mean? Really. I mean, here you look at me in Mayfair, the height of respectability. I mean, you should have seen me coming out of the Mean Fiddler probably 30 years ago, you know what I mean, at 4 a.m. after Divine playing a very alternative concert, you know. So, you know, you know, I lived in Amsterdam, I've lived in Rotterdam, I've lived in London. I always liked the kind of the alternative kind of scene floating around that city, you know what I mean? And I always immersed myself in every city I've lived in. Mm-hmm. I was involved in St. Patrick's Day kind of in Amsterdam and Rotterdam. And London. So, you know what I mean? And, you know, it must be strange for an English guy looking in and saying, how do the Irish do it? They manage to throw a party every year that is just fun with a little bit of excess drinking, which is not necessarily PC anymore. So we have to be careful. But, you know, we do throw a good party and, you know, you don't need to, you know, put out too many invites, you know. You just need the right people to come to the party. Mm. Little bit of old school, you know, like Pia Kaufman and Brian Turner down the end. You have a little bit of, you know, Mr. Gill from the Dairy and Clapham on the other end. Oh, you know what I mean?
So scene
it's
now.
It's no, but that's you have
it's
to
like
set
it's like
the
an
scene.
Painting.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You don't want a full of young bull, young cooks with tattoos going, I'm better than you, mate. You know, a bit of too much shortage, a little bit of that. And you make sure the booze is good. Grand Cru champagne, great Guinness. Don't mess them up too much by mixing one with the other. And really good cocktails. And what you want, and lots of food to keep everyone kind of, you know.
Soberish for now.
Soberish for now. So, you know, I started that here around, probably around, must be 5-6 years ago. It was always small. It was a small group of us. And it just, honestly, this has been the thing that's just got a little bit bigger.
Reputation.
Yeah. It's kind of the party everyone wants to come to. And believe it or not, it's not really that well organized. You know what I mean? We only do it 4 weeks before the St. Patrick's Day. It's not something we start planning the year before. But I always insist the right people come to it. You know what I mean? Like, it was great having Brian Turner. It was great having the chef from Bubble Dogs here this year. You know what I mean? Really, you know, I want a right splattering of English boys, a right splattering of Irish boys, and a few Welsh boys in the middle. You know what I mean? Really.
And then the rugby's on as well.
Yeah, and Cheltenham is on as well. So, you know what I mean? You don't need, it's a nice vibe. It's a really nice vibey week.
Amazing.
I remember the first year I came to it, I didn't know what to expect. And I actually thought I was kind of meeting some of your team to have a bit of a chat and a sit down. And I walked in.
Completely wrong thing then.
All these people there and my colleague hadn't arrived yet. And she rang me and I was like, I think I'm in the wrong place. There's a wedding on.
There's a wedding on. Everyone's having a good time.
Everyone's having a good time. I mean, the whole thing about it is, basically, there's no speeches being made. There's no people saying, welcome to my party in Mayfair. You know what I mean?
The sing songs.
Nobody. Jamie is my guitarist, which is a great story about Jamie. I was coming out after a very late night in Soho, and there Jamie was strumming on Shaftesbury Avenue a few Smith songs. And I stood there and I thought, you are the best ever at playing the Smiths. So this is around 7-8 years ago. So Jamie, who's from up north, you know what I mean, is now my kind of trumpeteur.
Yeah.
He is really, and he really gets the gig. So we have an Englishman singing. And by the way, our playlist is quite good, you know what I mean? Where it's quite Smiths heavy, you know what I mean? And we like a little bit of Clash. We like a little bit of, you know what I mean? So my St. Patrick's playlist is like, you know, alternative Britain, basically, with a little bit of Irish heritage here and there. And a little bit of more cool Lancome and, you know, a little bit more edgy kind of folky stuff from Scotland and Northeast England and Kent as well. I mean, there's great music going on around Britain and Ireland right now, guys. Really great. We can't take ownership of it, but there's great folk scene in Britain right now. It's fabulous.
So I went to Madrid a few years ago on St. Patrick's Day, and it was so crazy there. And I was like, why is this one of the only kind of traditions that translates to every country?
Well, that whole thing of fiesta party, you know what I mean, really? I mean, it's the Latin in the Irishness, really. There's no question about it, you know what I mean, really? You know, everyone is very controlled. You know, the Dutch haven't lived there for so long, you know what I mean? Everything is very, very straightforward, very organized. And you know what I mean? You'd die of boredom if you weren't careful. So you have to go out, you know what I mean? You know, the Paradiso and lots of other late night places was invented for those who was getting a little bit going to bed at 10:30.
Exactly.
My lifestyle.
I can't imagine that in Amsterdam. I think you get this picture of Amsterdam being just constantly crazy. But
yeah,
then
it's full of Brits and Germans and Irish being constantly crazy and from everywhere else in Europe. But the Dutch are quite sober. And quite organized, and you don't necessarily see it's all Dutch in the late drinking places in Amsterdam.
And you started in Holland, as in you moved there to be a chef, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I lived and worked there, yeah, for many years. So, you know, my first experience was late 82 when I was kind of dead Kennedys and the Smiths was just starting up, you know what I mean? So there was it was the last of the Vondel Park where all the hippies were hanging out from the 70s. And you know what I mean? There was that last of the people holding on to the hippie 70s, you know? And I kind of, there was just that last burst the crackers, which was the kind of people who were squatting in all the buildings. It was riots every night. It was crazy. I mean, I left Ireland. I thought that was a little bit
that's crazy.
Center.
Yeah, yeah.
And I arrived in Amsterdam to street riots with the squatters, you know what I mean, which was big in Berlin and Amsterdam at the time, being moved out of all these kind of derelict houses. And literally, there was riots every night outside the place I was living in. And I went, God, one war zone into another.
That's crazy. And then, so what was the food scene like in 82 in Holland?
Oh, it was quite interesting. You know, I worked in some very interesting restaurants, you know, smaller places, you know what I mean? Ketkanetons, a guy called Vogel, you know what I mean? A really serious operator, you know, very cool, very good. The restaurant scene was, you know, you always have to, it was like London. You had to find the places you wanted to work in Rotterdam, you know, La Villette. I worked in kind of French inspired kind of Michelin-y kind of thing, you know, but I always liked the Dutch classics as well, you know what I mean? I always immerse myself in the countries. I get to know the country geographically and its history, and, you know, I'm quite nosy like that. So, you know, the Dutch have things called ertensoep and stamppot en dijvie and boerenkool, and it's all farmers' food that people in middle kind of North England, the north of England, Lincolnshire, won't understand. You know what I mean? It's kale with mash. It's a smoked sausage on top of a potato. You know, and by the way, it's great drinking food.
Yeah, and it's...
It really is great drinking food.
What's the one you just said then with the cabbage and the mash?
Yeah, yeah, stamppot.
And then they put bacon
in it,
right?
That's basically veal sausage, endive mash with a bit of veal gravy. Boerenkool is farmer's cabbage, basically. You know what I mean? It'd be like... Irish equivalent would be culcannon, kale and mashed potato. Fantastic. And kale just was kind of quickly blanched and chopped up, tossed in a bit of butter and then chopped up well, but a little bite still in it, and then added into a nice buttery mashed potato. Honestly, it was food that you would rise from the grave from.
Beautiful. And it can keep you going, like
it
you're
can
saying.
Keep you going, which is very important in your 20s and 30s. Yeah?
In Amsterdam, maybe, you know, as well, when you're still trying to get rid of the hippies.
Well, you know, you're in Rotterdam as well. You know, you're down on the kind of the harbour side, you know what I mean, the Binnenwijks, and it's the last of the mad sailors, you know what I mean? It's almost, you know, Jack Braille singing Amsterdam, and, you know what I mean, eating fish heads and, you know what I mean, whores on the street, you know what I mean? It really was like that. I mean, everything is so sanitized now, you know what I mean? Everyone wants to, you know, people talk about the days of Soho. You know, honestly, we wouldn't even hang out in the days of Soho, of, you know, I know the Colony, you know what I mean? That kind of gutter, foot in the gutter stuff, you know what I mean? I mean, even the hipsters wouldn't hang around it. It's so smelly today. You know what I mean? So I love people talking about being cool and shortage. And so, yeah, get lost. You wouldn't even hang out with us for half a day, you lot. You know what I mean? You'd be gone after an hour and a half for a colonic irrigation, more than likely, you know?
I think at this point we should go right back. We're a bit of Amsterdam.
Yeah, you have the end. Yeah, the end result, yeah.
Because I know this is going to be good fun. So yeah. let's go right
and
back.
And I trust you to edit this very carefully.
We don't edit anything, man. This is the way, you know what I mean? This is the Soho of podcasts, you know what I mean? Let's go right back to your first food memories back home and when you were like a kid.
Yeah, I mean, you know, chefs talk about their backgrounds a lot. And they talk about their mothers a lot. You know, my mother was a decent cook. She wasn't a magical cook, you know what I mean, really. She cooked for 7 children in the house. We had a small farmstead. My father was a very keen fisherman and hunter, and we hunted for the table. So, you know, memories, people talk about memories, but I ate like a king. Eels, fried eels, brown bread, salads, kind of duck eggs, hen eggs, lightly boiled, chopped, bit of melted butter on it, brown bread. Piece of wild salmon for breakfast. I mean, we'd probably wild salmon for breakfast more than we had bacon and sausage.
That's crazy.
Do you understand?
Oh my God.
I mean, we're talking kind of Lincolnshire fens kind of foraging stuff. You know what I mean? Really. Young rabbit sautéed on a pan, which has to be my all time favorite dish, really, still to this day. So, you know, if there's a thing called, you know, tapini, Irish tapas, you know what I mean? That was our table. It was all put in the middle and we all helped ourselves to a cold bit of bacon, which we had killed the pig, or which heavily salted would have lasted for at least 4 or 5 months, which we killed twice a year. So there was always something to eat. The end result of some of the cooking of it, I have to say, you know what I mean, doesn't bring great memories. You know what I mean? I don't remember eating a kind of rare roast beef for Sunday lunch. It'd probably be a brisket or something, you know what I mean, cooked Chinese style till it was almost crisp by my mother. But saying that, if we had a steak, and when we did have a steak in the house, probably once a month, my father always cooked it on a cast iron pan and it'd be served blue. So, you know what I mean? There wasn't too many Irish households where you'd have a blue steak sitting on a plate. And to the horror of everyone in our family, no one can eat a well-done steak in our house. I mean, it's incredible, you know. We'd have a blue, just rub it on the pan and put it on the plate. And it's that kind of, you know, that comes out of respect for eating well. It doesn't.
So you didn't struggle with food growing up in terms of like being a kid and new tastes and, you know.
No, buttermilk. Once you're kind of making butter and when you churn and you make your butter, there's always the residue of the buttermilk left over. So you always kept that cool. And that was something that you make the bread from as well, where Mam made the bread every day. And we used it. You drank it during the summer, very chilled, you know, and the dairy was always in a very cold part of the outside area. So everything was very chilled in there anyway. Even on a hot summer's day, things were cold in there. And that's where the cooked meat would have been kept as well. And cheeses whatever butter we had. There wouldn't be too many farmhouse cheeses hanging around Ireland in those days. But, you know, there was always butter, warm bread, something cold in the larder, and lots of buttermilk. And buttermilk is a great quencher during during the hot summer times. You think of those yogurt drinks you have now. So I would imagine my gut kind of, you know what I mean, metabolism would have been very healthy in those years, you know what I mean?
And stood me
well for all those years of dark living, you know?
So when you've got this rich, like, kind of like, well, palate and plate and, you know, having this as a norm from when you're growing up, when did it go, oh God, other people don't eat like this?
I think when you go into other people's homes and you see kind of, you know, processed foods. And I think I was nosy about processed foods when I was in my teens, you know what I mean? Just out of interest, because some we were never brought up.
It's a novelty, isn't it?
It's a kind of a novelty. And you look at it and you go, God, that's interesting. And then you realize it's mush and pappy and, you know, and everything, that there's nothing in it. It's just filler. It's foam. You know,
bacon and water.
Absolutely. Rashers that kind of, you know, put in a pan and it's just the residue, just, and they shrink right in front of your eyes. I mean, we all have memories in our kind of 20s and, you know, not too much money in our pocket, you know, trying to pay for our tube tickets A to B. And I do remember when I was so broke after paying my rent in London, a couple of chefs, we clubbed together and bought a pack of rashers, you know what I mean, and a sliced pan or something and a bit of salad. And that was our lunch, you know what I mean? And that was our lunch till we went back to work on a Monday morning. So, you know, yeah, starting at that level, you know what I mean, of just not even being able to afford traveling to work after paying your rent for your absolute dump on Camden Road, you know what I mean, really. It was like, I always felt, having lived on the continent of Europe, and having first came to Camden Road, I really felt it was so Dickensian.
Mm.
There was something so 18th century about the rubbish in Camden. You could wade through it with waders, you know what I mean, on a Sunday morning.
Oh,
from the whole thing, you know. People jumping into the back of vans for a day's pay on the building sites. And, you know, the pogues, you know, just think about, you know, McGowan's lyrical kind of London Irish kind of rants, you know. He was honest, you know, he had his pulse on that kind of, you know, the underbelly of London, which wasn't so sanitized and wasn't so pretty. And, you know, everyone was just kind of knocking a living. And it was from day to day, week to week. And that was London. There was nothing amazing about it. You know, you went from one job to another. You know, there was no big career path, you know, by 2 years, you'll be there, you know.
Just doing it to make ends meet.
Well, I'm a prime example. If you hang around long enough, you'll get to the top. Really. Yeah, get the job. You live long enough, really.
That's mad.
So where do you think your interest in food first stemmed from?
I think always on the farm. I looking after animals, I've been doing all my life. You know, milking, I've been doing most of my young life.
So you got your hands dirty from early
age? Very much so. I was on a machine. I was on a tractor at 11 or 12. I mean, health and safety would...
Doesn't matter, does it, when you're a farmer's kid?
I'm talking about 800 horsepower tractors. We're not talking about something run around little lawnmower. You know what I mean? You're out bobbing straw, turning straw after the harvesting to dry it, you know, probably 200 acres of it, you know. You're out there for the whole day on your own, you know what I mean? You're 12.
That's crazy.
running up and down. You could just imagine health and safety. Just, they close your farm down today if they caught that going on, you know what I mean? And learning to drive kind of big machines, Sanderson forklifts, you know what I mean? Cutting silage, bringing in silage from their fields. You know what I mean? You were on tractors, you know, big Massey Ferguson's, you know, booting down the roads. You know what I mean? Really.
So much fun. I remember I had a
friend. Yeah, it was wild. You know what it gives you? It gives you lots of confidence. If anything, it, you know what I mean? And don't pretend it gives you great confidence. I don't know that, but I'll try it.
Yeah.
You know, it gives, it's great for young boys in particular to be working and kept busy at that age and given responsibility to go out and do things. Said, can't do that. You can't do that. You have a license to do that. No, no, you can't drink till you're 18. Oh, give me a break. You know what I mean? Really. So I think you end up at 15 being quite prepared for life.
And you've grafted before you've even started.
And you've done the 15 hours a day, you know what I mean, at a very early age, and you keep doing that for most of your life. As I said before, stick around. You always get to the top.
And then you've got your dad there who's hunting and fishing.
Oh, so yeah.
You saw, you know, what happens to an animal.
Yeah, there's certain parts of the countryside. I won't say that it's all beautiful and clean and sanitized. I mean, hunting foxes and rabbiting with ferrets and all that. I'm not so keen on that anymore, I have to say. I'm not so keen on driven shoots anymore and things like that. I don't mind a bit of hedgerow kind of shooting for the table, which my dad done. But anything organised, I'm very much against. Very much against. Yeah. Anything that people just turn into killing for no reason.
A sport, almost.
Sport. I've gone the other way completely. I've been out in the countryside. People shooting ducks. I put down a gun. I go home in disgust. I'll be honest. I'm not interested. Of killing for sport. I love shooting something for the table. I'll tell you, don't get me in the way of a mallard, you know what I mean, really? I mean, you know, a rabbit or a hare, you know what I mean? And I don't necessarily want hare anymore. I don't put hare in my menu because hares pair up. Right. Wild ducks pair up. So, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know what I mean? You know.
And did you go on
anything that, anything like that, and there's a reason why, you know what I mean, you shouldn't do certain things. And if you understand the countryside, you know what to take and you know what to give back and you know when to leave things alone. You don't want to be killing kind of woodcock when the resident population is very low, you know, or snipe, the numbers are not right. You know what I mean? Just leave them alone for a few years. Let the numbers come back in. And they do, you know what I mean? And you have to look after the countryside. Mm.
Do you think the customers understand that as much as well now?
I've always kind of expressed it on the menu one way or the other, you know what I mean, to be kind of the seasonal kind of natural approach. I mean, you know, I have a farm which we're above organic. I mean, I hate the word organic, I have to tell you, but it's a term that people understand and it recognises that this is something. Adrian Gill, which is a great food writer in London who died a few years ago. I loved Adrian, I have to tell you. I loved his... He had a kind of great cynicism about it all. And his brother, Nick, disappeared as a chef. You know what I mean? I was never found. And Adrian, I remember when I opened Bentley's, you know, I was so proud. I said, Adrian, the butter's organic. It's amazing. You have to taste this. And he turned around and he picked up the jug of milk. And he said, hey, Richard, is the milk organic? And I hung my head in shame and went back into the kitchen. And I went, oh, God, you absolute dick. Absolute dick. Yeah. Stay in the kitchen. Never come out again.
Amazing.
So, you know, it's always good to ask the right questions, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so you got your interest from your upbringing, basically. What was the kind of switch-on moment when you thought, right, actually, why I want to be a chef?
Well, I think in the rural community, historically, you know, the eldest boy got the farm or got any interest in the farm or neighbouring farms or whatever the family and relations would always do. So my brother John basically got the farm, more than, you know, even though he wasn't necessarily a farmer at the time. I will openly say I always thought he was a very bad farmer for most of my working life. And that was probably just a little resentment of him getting the farm. But he has gone natural farming now, which is, it's taken him a long time, I have to say. probably 30 years to realize the natural method was much better than the way the route he went down. But I have to say, he's now part of the proper property farming structure in the rural countryside, and very much au naturel. So I'm happy that he's making that great U-turn in his life. So as I said, the older brother kind of gets the farm, and you go off and you do something, and and let's be honest with you, people say, I was training to be a chemist and I ended up a chef, and God almighty, I mean, are you off your head? Wouldn't you beat the guy with your shoe and kick him in the ass to get back to university and become a chemist? Because, let's be honest, it's just in a sweaty, hot kitchen, and there's orders coming at you like an avalanche coming down the mountain. Ain't a pretty place to be at 56. It's pretty stressful. And all those chefs, looking very clean and very nice and say, I work all those hours every day. Give me a break. I mean, they're greatest fibers in the world. We need our youth. We need the young 20s and 30s and, lots of enthusiasm, lots of ideas. And you end up then being the Herbert von Strachan of the kitchen world, conducting it all, from a safe distance, a little safe distance. And, what you do is you have to taste everything, see everything, and you become a conductor. But the whole idea of, chefs telling me they get in at 6:30 now and they leave at 12 o'clock. Listen, they wouldn't last with me 2 hours in the Groucho Club, never mind work 16 hours in their own kitchens, most of them.
I want to hear about when you were that young buck, when you came from from farming background, when you walked in there at 16,
yeah,
were the people, because they haven't grafted on tractors before, they haven't been having salmon for breakfast, you know what I mean?
No.
What was it like when you walked in? What was the first position you walked into?
This is the odd thing. Most people end up doing something for half their life and then realizing one morning when they wake up in an absolute blind panic that half their life or most their life has passed by. And they hate what to do. Mm. I'm going to say to you, at 56 years of age, I love what I do. I've always loved what I do. I've loved what I do from the age of 15, and I'm 56 now, and I still love what I do. I think I meet the most interesting of people. I learn something new every day. I read an article by Diane Henry or Rolly Lee or Simon Hopkinson, and I pick up a little tip here and something. You're forever picking up little tips of knowledge, You read a review, good or bad, from Janoir, really, and and you go, wow, that's interesting. God, did I deserve that? And then you realize you don't get too many bad or good ones, but they're always fair and they're always nice. And by the way, restaurant criticism, You're not discovering new stars. You're not discovering a new vaccine against some incredibly terrible virus. You're sitting above a great heap of people, which Brendan Behan once called, really. Basically, you're like a eunuch looking in at a sex party, really, I have to tell you. And that's what most food criticism is about. They're always looking in. They're unable to join in. And they dearly wish they could.
I think you're true. Yeah. Get in there. Go on.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, my word.
That is great. So, yeah. Your first job in a proper kitchen.
My first job in a proper kitchen was a local hotel called Kerwin Arms in Athboy, which was owned by Sean and Rita Kerwin, wonderful people, Dublin family. And they had this very busy country hotel. It could be anywhere, like in rural England, you had your weddings, your family get-togethers, and all the race meetings, of course, would be a place where people would come and have kind of dinner, lunch and dinner. So, you learn how to cook a collar of bacon, you learn what a lamb chop was, nice rosé. What good meat was, well hung, proper, nice bit of game. We used to get in whole veal carcasses, and the chef Ray would butcher them all up. And so he was on the ships, worked for the cruise liner. So the knowledge that he had in bacon, pastry, and just general cookery was absolutely fantastic. So, but it wasn't hot cuisine. It was good country, busy family orientated place. And it was a great learning curve. Stayed there for 2 years. Then I moved up on the Fermanagh border to a hotel, and Kyle Moore, and basically we worked there for probably a year and a half, and that probably 17 and a half, I left there and I went to live in Amsterdam. Through a contact of the family, believe it or not, there was a Dutch guy working in a hotel that was going back to Amsterdam, and I think they were looking for some chefs in Amsterdam at the time, and someone said something to me, and of course I was in like Flynn, you know what I mean, on a plane, and out I went, you know. I mean, most 17-year-olds wouldn't even be able to pack their own suitcase today, you know what I mean? My mummy would be buying them, you know what I mean, rations for the first 6 months in case they died of starvation, you know what I mean? So yeah, you're on your own, you're living it. And then Amsterdam was a great eye-opener. I met a great English guy in Amsterdam called Mark Needham. And Mark was, he went to school in Rugby, you know what I mean? He was a very well-educated guy. And he was kind of one of those kind of post-hippie dudes hanging around Amsterdam. And he introduced me to, first of all, he got me a library card. He brought me down to the Amsterdam Bibliothek. And he introduced me then to Kurt Vonnegut and Steinbeck and, you know, made me read The Guardian Observer every bloody day and every Sunday. And so I became a lefty British, you know what I mean? My politics is... Yeah, absolutely. My politics hasn't changed from the day. Even, you know, I'd make a perfect Tory material, but I just can't be one. You know what I mean? I'm perfect. You know what I mean? Really, I have it all. You know what I mean? But can never be one. Impossible.
Good.
It's impossible.
It's amazing how, like, you can meet someone and they can affect you for so long. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like a mentor,
Mark,
or a friend.
Mark, it's great. And especially for young people in general, you know, to meet mentors. I've been very lucky. I've met some great mentors in my life. You know what I mean? I've always kind of came across great, you know, everyone needs their gurus, you know, their teachers, their people that inspires. And Mark Needham was one of those individuals. And I want to give him a shout out today because, you know, we don't normally give people shouts out that have influenced our background. And Mark, when I arrived in Amsterdam, you know, that could have all went horribly wrong. You know what I mean? You never know what den you'd have ended up in. You know what I mean? So meeting Mark was an amazing. And he introduced me, of course, to the Smiths and the Kennedys and lots of alternative kind of stuff, which I love, absolutely love. You know what I mean? So, you know, that kind of sets your course in your head and your thinking. And it sets your kind of thinking about food as well. You know, your kind of the honesty in everything. You know what I mean? There has to be an integrity in music. There has to be integrity in food. You just can't be flipping around making dots on a plate.
So when did you kind of get the confidence in your own ability?
Well, you know what I mean? Probably at the very beginning, you've no confidence in your own ability. You know what I mean? I wasn't necessarily born with it, you know. But, you know, as the old saying goes, you know, if anyone can do it, you can do it. You know what I mean? So, you know, the world is full of blaggers, you know what I mean, really, and everything else. And I don't think I'm any different. You know what I mean? I just don't, you know, if I don't know something, I put up my hand and say, I don't know how to do that. Can someone just tell me exactly what you want? So you learn and you absorb, and, you know, people talk about kind of foodie geniuses, you know what I mean? There might have been a few great food writers, but I think food in general is picked up, and, you know what I mean? There's, you know, everything is kind of over elaborated and
overhyped as well.
And overhyped, and, you know what I mean? Daddy, daddy, da. At the end of the day, it's nourishment, and you might as well eat well and drink well than just eat badly and drink badly. And eating badly doesn't mean going to the biggest and priciest restaurants. It just means, you know, getting off your ass, finding the product and cooking it yourself as well. So, you know, a perfect piece of bacon, you know what I mean? My perfect piece of bacon is a really wonderful colour of bacon, and I haven't found anyone in the UK. I don't know what it is that does an incredible, beautiful colour of salted bacon. And it's something I can find, you know, with lots of little abattoirs and little butchers in Ireland. And I find it really hard to find here. Or people call it kind of, you know. So I love that kind of a freshly cooked piece of gammon, rested with some kale and even a little bit of green chili in the kale. It doesn't really matter. You can move around these days, you know what I mean? Served with a kind of lentils, and that could have a little bit of Indian spice in it. You know, it doesn't really matter anymore. But once Coleman's mustard is nearby, to put on that piece of warm gammon, I would say that is perfection to me. A little piece of rabbit, young, on the bone, sautéed on the pan, or just fried on the pan with a bit of butter carefully. a little bit of wild garlic thrown into it, if you have it. If you don't, who cares? But let it rest it again and just picked up and just eat with your hands. They're the memories of my childhood. They're the memories of being a young boy from the farm. They are the things that rabbit meat, you know what I mean? Kind of, you know, hen's eggs, duck eggs, you know what I mean? Broken up and kind of just made into a kind of a rumbled kind of scrambled egg, you know, served with a salad and some brown bread. Those are the things that say, yeah, yummy, yummy, yum to me. Mm-hmm. And still, I feel yummy, yummy, yum about them. They are the flavors that has never left my head and never will leave my head. And probably your Last Supper stuff would be, you know what I mean, a beautiful scrambled duck egg with lots of country butter in it. And that's, you know, and maybe a glass of Pinot Noir these days. But, you know, it's interesting what people, you know, I think people are so short of, so short focused these days. It's new. Mm. Instead of just stopping and sitting on an oyster bar and taking a native number two with nothing on it, really. The amateurs put lemon juice on it. The utter absolute idiots. I've seen some of the greatest food writers put lemon and vinegar on a native oyster. I really want to give them a slap in the ear. And then, you know what I mean? So most people don't know how to eat. They might know how to write about food, but most people don't know how to eat.
Mm. I think people get afraid of asking questions, you know what I mean? As a customer.
Yeah, ask.
Like if you go to a really expensive place or like a really beautiful place you're looking forward to, you don't want to show yourself. I don't want to show myself up as a, like, you know, commoner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to be told, by the way, that oyster, have it on its own.
On its own. Like, it's like just the flavour.
On
the coast, people eat it. You know, the oyster men would eat just an oyster just out of the shell, you know. The whole thing of lemon juice, you know what I mean? Just a medieval kind of introduction to smelly fish, basically. You know what I mean? If you want to know your history of it. But and of course, it does go. A nice bit of lemon juice and a nice piece of white fish can be a bit of olive oil. Can be the most delicious thing in the world to enjoy with a little sun going down and a little bit of green on the plate. Wonderful. But you don't squeeze it on everything. You don't put lemon juice on a mackerel. You only put a dash of vinegar on a mackerel because lemon juice makes your gut kind of just bring it all back up and just reflux. So you never put lemon juice in a mackerel. Of course, most chefs know that, but you'd be surprised how many don't.
You've been educated well. Do you think it's educated through back in the farm and then the people you met along the way? Like the chef that you're saying, like, you know, proper, ran the business properly all the time, you know?
Yeah, you know, you have to remember, farming is a business. Restaurants are a business. You know what I mean? There's lots of people in there. And, you know, that we're still surviving as London is going through a bit of a flux at the moment. And I'm going to say, that's my superstition. Touch wood. Don't ever think you're above anybody else. I think we work quite hard at staying around. I like to pay my bills, my wine merchants, my food, my staff, my taxes, my corporation taxes. I feel very much part of society. You know what I mean? I'm not Amazon, which, you know what I mean? I'm not someone, Rees-Mogg this morning, 110 million profit and not a penny shared with the British Exchequer for nurses, doctors, policemen or the military. You know what I mean? I mean, that's not society, guys. You know what I mean? I think if you're going to do something, you have to understand the bigger picture. The bigger picture is kind of looking after the things you like, you know, which is, I like the countryside. I like planting things. I like planting trees. I think it's wonderful. I never sit under any of them. But someone planted them in the 1700s that we sit under now, you know. So, you know, I think we have to take a much longer term view of our place on this planet and the little things we should do to it. And it's not putting kind of, you know, farming effluent into the local rivers and polluting the lakes. You know, so farming has to play their part. You know, putting fertilizers, over fertilizing and over, you know, excess kind of, you know, the slurry onto land at bad times of the year with massive runoffs. And, you know, the soil can only absorb so much damage from the human, from us. You know what I mean? You plow it, you rotivate it, you plow it, you harrow it, you rotivate it. Constant murdering that lovely top 12 to 9 inches, you know, until it becomes so compacted, you know what I mean? You can't even, it won't even absorb any nutrients. So, you know, a healthy soil, you know what I mean? You have to understand the ground, the soil, the terroir. The French always talk about the terroir. we think it's a lovely pretentious word where vineyards talk about it, but it's not. The tower, it's the ground, it's the soil, you know what I mean? The healthy environment, so many worms per meter of soil, you know, all of that. All of it, you know, you have to, you know, in Ireland, you know, in our operation in Ireland, you know, we banned black bags there. It was quite interesting. Black bags, my God. We love plastic in kitchens, cling film, you name it, we have it. We banned black bags and we compost, hot compost everything. I got a company called Reapin, they're basically down in Cornwall, to come over to Ireland, set me up these two big hot composting operations. Huge, from that wall to there. Huge operation. And getting everyone into this, getting everyone to break up everything in the kitchen. Ding, ding, separation of everything. And you know what I'm really surprised about? The amount of polystyrene and plastics that come into houses, including your own house. And you can imagine that multiplied by so much into professional working kitchens and hotels and restaurants and houses and estates. The amount of polystyrene, plastics, cardboard...
Cardboard is the big one.
It's,
you get a box.
And of course, we crush our glass. We bale our cardboard. We had a company to take the cardboard away up to last year. And then all of a sudden, the price fell away and no one wanted to touch it. You understand? Yeah. It's almost like a commodity. They want it when there's money in it. No one wants to take it away when there's nothing in it. But the hot composting has been my greatest success.
You're big on all that stuff, though, aren't you?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm learning on the way through the whole time. I'm not putting myself up. I'm a guardian angel. I'm willing to move in the right direction always and look at the best possible scenario. And I'm not putting signs outside my door saying I love the countryside and I love organics. I just think it's pathetic, I have to tell you. It becomes a bit of a mission statement for so many people. And, you know, it's different. It's deeper than that. I just think we have to be careful of, you know, because, you know, we still get into a diesel taxi and take a trip around the corner. So there goes whatever good you've done yesterday. You know what I mean? So I think it's important that we all do our little bit. And I try to do my little bit. But I've been absolutely amazed by the success of the composting operation. And being a farmer, I'm always thinking, I wonder could I multiply this by 100 million times and create gas from it and sell the compost and sell the gas to the mainstream. And that's what the farming head does to you. You're always thinking of, God, I love this. God, how do you turn eco into profit? You know what I mean? Or make it a business. So there's always that going on inside your head. And if it's not going on inside anyone's head in the restaurant business, then, you know, clearly you're telling lots of fibs as well. Because the restaurant business... it is a business that we all live from, that we pay lots of staff from. So, you know, it's pointless saying being in the restaurant business and, you know, it all goes horribly wrong and you're out of business pretty quickly.
Well, when you've had a place for as long as you've had, especially, you need to move with the times. The times will swallow you up.
No, absolutely. And, you know, a decade is a long time in a restaurant, you know. And you know, I've done lots of different things as well, you know. I kind of have lots of, you know, I'm at an age when I have lots of different experience through my life. And, you know, I just, you know, just, you know, there's been, not everything is success you're ever going to do. There's no question about that. But varied experiences in food, you know, and you end up kind of, you know, you end up realizing one thing. You're only as good as the team around you, no matter who you are. And the team does change from time to time. And you'll always have someone in the team that you think, how did he get into this team? Or she? Or how did they get in? And did you employ them? Yes, I did. I am terrible at employing people. I leave it to other people. I'm a sucker for a good story, I have to tell you.
It's something that you never get taught, though, is it? Especially as a chef, because you've gone in there.
Yeah.
Normally you've worked with 50 people in hotels and that. And then, you know, no one goes, by the way, you have to do this to employ these people.
Absolutely.
Because you can choose. Everyone could do a good interview. Everyone could do a good week, absolutely, first week. And then they go, and they turn it into frigging nightmares, don't they, after that?
As for CVs, I mean, you might as well not read them. Because, honestly.
You can't be asked to read them because you've got 100 of them.
Absolutely. Well, it's not just that. But, you know, it's the fibs that's told on them. It's, you know what I mean? Really, you were there for how long? Are you sure? I know that, chef. And all of a sudden, you just see their face drop into the floor. You know what I mean? or I work with that guy for a year. Are you sure you're
with
that?
Yeah.
Like the
apprentice.
You know what
I
mean?
Oh, my God.
Like,
I always
think, has anyone ever checked how many GCSEs I've got? really? Has anyone ever gone, I'm going to ring his high school?
Yeah.
Do you remember that lad, the little shit? Yeah. Did he get 9? Because he looks like a 4. Do you know what I mean?
Didn't turn up in the last year.
Yeah, I know. I missed the maths. I slept
but,
in.
You know, it is the food business that we're in, and it is a business, I keep saying. But, you know, we have a big grow operation going on right now, a very big grow operation. And kind of, you know, there is chefs out there with a raised bed in their back garden. We've gone field scale. I've learned a lot. We planted an orchard, and I will say publicly, we had to dig it up and plant it again the following year. So everything you can do wrong, I think I've done it. I'm not afraid to admit the things. I planted my orchard, right? And I call it my orchard. I'm so proud. I went to UCD in Dublin to the Heritage Collection. My gardener did, Sarah, at the time. And we made an error. We just planted them too deep. And of course, we're never going to prosper. And my consultant gardener came in, Daphne Shackleton, and absolutely off the Explorer family fame. And she looked at the trees and said, "Who planted those?"
Oh, Richard,
get me out of here right now. And that's why you need people who know what they're doing around you. You can't do everything yourself, but once you bring in the right people to help you on the way through, it's extraordinary kind of the things you learn. I things do irritate me. A little bit of people who say they can do something and then opposite happens.
Don't deliver.
I must say, well, delivery is it can be measured in many ways, you know. But even though I've got 50% of such as said that give me at the beginning, I'm normally tolerant of something.
Right.
But when I get 10%, that's when I feel, hang on here.
Yeah, of
this
course.
Is not a fair exchange.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you kind of float around. You meet lots of people doing this and that. And honestly, here we are talking about food on an amazing trees. My God, I mean, three people and we're talking about food. But, you know, the real element of everything is integrity. You know what I mean? Don't become somebody you're not. I think that's the key, you know. And dealing with the public, you know, as you get older, you know, and probably everyone kind of would say this, you know, it's, you know, you can't smile for everyone and you shouldn't smile for everyone. That big fake smile that you'd be on that American, welcome, how are you today, sir? I mean, how do you do it? No wonder you need cash tips. Yeah, you know, 25%, you'd need it because that's the only way you're going to bloody smile. You know, so it's, you know, just working the hours, the graft and the monotony of it all as well, the repetition of the whole time. You know, it can just take its toll as well. So I think, you know, you surround yourself with some really fresh, smart, young folk. And if anything, in the last probably 30 years, the people in our industry, they're brighter, they're smarter, they're more knowledgeable, and the future is in great hands. Never been as good. And it probably will even get better. So it's not about always the old days, you know. I think there's an awful lot of stuff going on. I think that's fascinating today, really.
I saw you last year on Great British Menu as a judge, and when your face, when you ate Tom Brown's Poor Man's Goose.
Absolutely.
I have never seen a man so happy or proud.
It was very good.
It was outstanding.
He shouldn't have changed the recipe. He'd have brought that to the final. He changed the recipe, I think, second time around, you know. Tom, do you know what? I see a lot of cooks in town, and it's nice to see Tom. It's nice to see him do so well. It's nice to see, you know, the next generation coming up.
He was the first guest on this podcast.
Was he really?
Yeah.
I like Tom.
I like him a lot.
He's a great guy. I think he's an amazing future ahead of him. And, you know, once he keeps everything in perspective, because he's a young guy, and once you keep everything in perspective and not think you're too great, because there's a lot of life to live. You don't want to live it all in 5 years.
You've done 30 years in the
35.
Game. 35 years.
Yeah.
Was there any point, it's a weird question, but was there any point that you slipped, the integrity might have slipped a bit? Because like you came through that 90s kind of when it became the rock star job, you know, on TV a bit and everyone was going.
I opened a pub in the 90s called Mulligan's in Cork Street and I started serving boiled ham and lentils and cabbage.
So you went
I went the complete opposite.
That's what I wanted to hear. That's what I wanted to hear.
I'd done the opposite. And I remember Gary Rhodes saying, I'd say this to Gary because he's an amazing guy and he's a customer of my restaurant, believe it or not, when he comes to London. Gary was in the greenhouse, you know what I mean, doing some kind of great British food and whatever. I was serving a gammon with lentils and having a few pints of Guinness after work myself. And we got time out rest of the year. I went to someone, God, how do we manage that? Well, clearly, if you do something au naturel and it comes from the heart and the soul, it's a nice place to hang out. And everyone feels, this is real. This is real. No one is trying too hard. But I've always liked spoken word. I've always liked alternative music. And I've always liked the whole thing about, you know, everything changes. And, you know, I think we are in a changing place of kind of super kind of fine dining restaurants. You know what I mean? I think it'll all change. You know what I mean? Where, you know, it comes and goes. You understand? And central London probably is under a bit of pressure today when no one ever thought it'd be under any pressure. You know, everyone thought Mayfair is a bulletproof area. Well, it is, and we're still here. But it's not as bulletproof as people imagine because the restaurants do close in Mayfair all the time. And, you know, I mean, I think there's an amazing chef, Anthony Demetrius, you know what I mean? I do. And we have to talk about some great cooks out there as well. I think Anthony has left his mark in London brilliantly in two great restaurants as well. And I was very surprised that, you know, his restaurant, you know, closed and he sold up. Because, you know, there is a craftsman, you know, there is an incredible guy as well who's left an amazing mark in food in London. But it just shows you, at the end of the day, we all become something else, you know. And, you know, all my kids are in the business. It's quite interesting. I love this kind of industry, you know.
Missed hospitality, I read. Is that weird to know that? Missed hospitality.
Listen, that's... You know what? We throw good parties. But, you know, my eldest son is in the business, Richard. He's in Hong Kong and Belong. Just got a Michelin star in December. You know, Jessica is in the business. She works for Source Communications as an accounts director. And my son has just entered hotel school. So I don't look at this as some part-time job. I look at this as an industry with lots of opportunities, you know what I mean, really. And once you move on from the failures quickly, you know what I mean, it's fantastic. Don't hang around failures too long. Just get on the scooter and just go, God, why did I get involved here? Who put me into, who asked me to be a shareholder in this? You know what I mean? Really? So I just think it's great, you know, it's great you have a little laugh and a little bit of fun. But I will do something else, you know what I mean? There's something else brewing in my head right now, and it's probably more East London.
Okay.
And it's kind of, you know, more Hackney kind of inner city Dublin kind of vibe, you know what I mean, really, music wise, you know what I mean.
You just want to serve lentils and gammon and Guinness.
Yes.
Simple as.
I just think there's lots of great creative stuff going on. And I think you must be around creatives all of the time. It's really important that you keep your mind fresh and you just don't become bogged down in just the whole business of it all, you know what
I mean? Is that your motivation then?
Yeah, you know, I've hired last year, you know, we had a big fundamental rethink in it because, you know, your head was getting kind of wrecked and yeah, I'm a bit very much hands-on everything. So, you know, there's a proper accounts team in the company and they really run the business part of things. So it allows you then to be a little bit more, what's this and that, what you're good at, you know.
Creativity.
If you start minuscule kind of management of everything, it becomes absolutely boring. So, you know, we've made some fundamental changes. You know, we brought in a wonderful Elizabeth, you know, to be our ops in everything and deal with the day-to-day stuff. And that's fantastic because, you know, you need great people, you know what I mean? You just need great people. And, you know, we do something every 5 years, you know what I mean? Virginia Park Lodge in Ireland was my last project, which probably nearly I can say openly could have called it a project far too far. But we've got through it. There was times when I thought this is it. There isn't enough cash in the Bank of England to finish this project, you know. But we got there and the business came through the door. And thank you, everyone who supported it. Because there was a moment when I thought, ooh, I think I've just over-egged the pudding. This is going to be a big curdle on me. But we got by that one. And the gardens are, you know, to see something, of all the things I've done, Bentley's was amazing. I worked in Bentley's, the head chef, 24 years ago. So, you know, I only put it back to what it was then, you know what I mean, really. So, you know, I can't claim too much for that, really. But I made sure the oysters were native and they were, you know what I mean?
No lemons in the house.
Yeah.
Hide them bloody lemons.
Yeah, the crab was boiled and picked every day. We put the bakery in downstairs, you know, which I'm really proud of, you know. So you end up at Bentley's. Say, everyone gets kind of Bentley's kind of, is it a restaurant? Bentley's was always a tavern so that you can go in and have a beer. There's two beers. There's a stout, you know, the Neuster stout or a Hackney kind of lager. So Bentley's was always a tavern where you could have a beer. And that's really, really fundamental to anything. And all my bars have a beer on them and always had. Now, here I am in Upper Grosvenor Street. You can come in and have a Guinness and a beer here.
It really annoys me where you can only get a bloody bottle somewhere. Yeah, so all you want is a pint. I'm like, I don't want a frigging bottle. I want to have a beer for more than 20 minutes.
So, you know, but you can have a beer. And I think that's really important. It kind of, it's that level of hospitality. You don't need to come in and have a glass of champagne. Mm. You know what I mean? Really, you can come in and have a beer.
Yeah, it breaks down that level of like.
Yeah, it does. And there's so many people come out of work and they just want a beer. Yeah. So I just love having a beer on draft on the bars. And it's kind of something we do have done and always have done, and I just think it's just it sets the tone nicely on what you're trying to achieve. And you know, we're 10 years here in Corrigan's Mayfair, you know, 14 going on 15 years in Bentley's. But Bentley's been there for 100 years, so you know, in many ways, you know, to, you know, I had a half a dozen oysters on Bentley's bar yesterday. And I sat there, you know, and I just ordered three things from the blackboard, and I had a half dozen natives because it'd be finishing up soon enough. And I just thought, God, how pleasurable just to sit here on your own and just have.
Do you get to do that oysters. A lot?
Not a lot. No. It was odd yesterday. It just happened. And, you know, it was a late lunch, and I just thought, this is just yum. And, you know, unfussed around with, you know what I mean? The chef not telling you about his philosophy. Just you sit there. And Elio, one of the most amazing people in the world, 72 years of age and still opening oysters, you know what I mean, really. And I hired Elio for a reason. I wanted him to pass his knowledge to the boys underneath him. And Frederico underneath him, for example, you know what I mean, he used to run trays of food up and down the stairs and then make coffee. Now he's like number four in the world of opening oysters. I mean, they do have World Oyster Open Championships, believe it or not, yeah. And of course, now he's a superstar. I find it very hard to hold on to his ego, you know what I mean, really. So I leather him every day.
You know what I mean? Don't want. Just, yeah. Doing with toes.
He's the fastest oyster opener. He's the fastest in Britain. He's number one in Britain in the last 2 years. Britain and Ireland, I think. Yeah. Britain, I think. Yeah, Britain. And he goes off to China then every year, off to Norway for these. It's incredible. So the skill these guys learn and the knives that come back with, an oyster knife that's costing like 270 quid, you know what I mean? Just these, you know, he opens it with one and then he turns it with the other. So there's a new, I mean, I haven't seen it before. There's a new kind of opening oyster.
You don't need to open your own. You've got bloody them too, have you?
Yeah, they crack them. They crack them with one part of the knife. And because there might be a little bit of kind of seabed or a little bit of muck from the oyster on the knife, then you turn it with another knife, part of the knife, so it doesn't contaminate from the shell into the oyster.
So you just got pure, clean.
Yeah,
native.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to watch and go, that's an interesting knife. How much was that? 270 quid.
I mean,
Where does that come from? Norway. I mean, so everything is getting more expensive, more hipster, but there's another layer of knowledge coming in that just wasn't there even 10 years ago.
And you learn from it as well. Do you know what I mean? You learn from these guys. You seem like the more, like, you say you're all romantic when it comes to, you know what I mean? Like, romantic, yeah, and kind of, I mean, like, really. Tradition.
Yeah, I think tradition is important. I mean, once you don't, nothing is set in concrete. Tradition, once the fundamentals remain the same, you know what I mean? Things can be fluid. You know, but, you know, just things set in concrete for the sake of set in concrete. I just think eating habits change. People are getting, you know, I mean, there's a big movement of vegans at the moment. You know, I had a bit of a run-in with the vegan community a few weeks ago.
How'd that end?
Oh, they know somebody. I never got the most vile abuse came my way from the most militant anti. But by the way, I didn't tell them that I had, you know, the most best vegetable garden you could ever imagine as a guy. You know what I mean? Our methods is above everything else. And but I wasn't even going to even have that conversation with them. But it was interesting, the vileness of
aggressiveness,
the aggressiveness, and so a lot of. So I just love that kind of battle, I have to tell you. I think I call one bitter and twisted, and that set the whole world in motion. And then I thought, I better apologize because I had three glasses of wine. you know what I mean, really? And I thought, listen, you're not too bad. And then you realize, oh, what the hell was I apologizing for? You're all a bunch of lunatics, frankly. But you know what? If you are a vegan, just be a vegan.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's going to look after you really well. But, you know, when you're trying to convince, you know, I don't like Puritans. You know what I mean? Really. I am a bit of a one, but I don't necessarily like them. I don't like people forcing anything down anyone else's neck. I'm a very democratic on those things.
Right,
you know
what
I mean? Really. You know what I mean? I'm very democratic, you know. It's almost like watching Brexit, I have to tell you. It's the perfect English coup, isn't it, really?
It's all outspoken chef. And I thought, when I read that, I was like, every chef's bloody outspoken. What are you on about? Do you know what I mean? When they say about, because obviously you...
Yeah.
It's good to have opinions, but the thing is that you've always said for it, they're my opinions.
Yeah,
it's
not like I'm not trying to force anyone else. You can be who you want and what you want, but you should listen to people with life experiences, which have lived in different places and seen it. But the whole vegan thing, I've had vegan food from the time I lived in Rotterdam. I used to hang out in vegan restaurants. When I was in Soho in Lindsay House, I used to go around to Hare Krishna Cafe in Soho Square.
It was cheap.
It was like £3.70 or something, even £2. You made a donation. And of course, I'd be slightly hungover in those days, you know what I mean? And I wanted something a little spicy and natural. I didn't want any meat. I just wanted something spicy. And I remember going into Hare Krishna and you get the metal tray, you know what I mean? And I sat there. I really thought, now this has taken the extreme of eating to such a kind of a Presbyterian view that it's substance. And with just about nourishment to keep you alive. And then you never really see a fat Hare Krishna
guy running
around. You know what I mean, really?
Struggling down Tottenham Court Road.
Down Compton Street, yeah. Ringing the bell, you know what I mean, really. And I just always feel, you know what? I'm a gluttonous person.
Right.
You know what I mean? If there was a slice of bacon or a slice of boiled gammon sitting in front of me and it was me and you...
I've lost.
I might stab you to get it.
With that £270 bloody knife. God.
Well, speaking of opinions, what places, what restaurants, what dishes have you had lately that's kind of blown you away?
Good question. It's a restaurant in Ireland that I tweeted about it after coming out that night. I got in trouble with the vegans on the same night, by the way.
That must be a good night. Too many,
God almighty,
too many sherries.
I went to a little restaurant in a place called Selbridge. I think it's Selbridge, outside of it's in Kildare. I was going across country, and a friend of mine, Sean Vaughan, said to me, "I there's a little restaurant here. I think the two guys the boy and girl used to work in the Ledbury." I went, "What? Let's head in here.
Monster in there.
This is the deal. They were full."
Oh.
And of course I blagged it. I said, I'll eat in the waiting area. So I convinced this wonderful, wonderful couple. They were full. And I was eating in the waiting area in a low table with my friend. And we had a lovely bottle of wine. Sean was driving. So I had a bottle of wine. And honestly, dish after dish just came out. And I just thought, I think the future is great. I really, that's what I felt. The future is great. The restaurant is called Two Cooks. That's what the restaurant is called, Two Cooks. They both worked in London for years. They've opened a little place. But you know what was amazing that night? Ronnie Wood was in for dinner.
He's everywhere. He gets bloody everywhere, Wood.
What was Ronnie Wood doing in my newfound little private little place in the middle of Ireland?
Do you have a crack with him?
Ronnie, he went upstairs. He had a reservation.
Of course he bloody did.
And he was in with his partner, wife, I don't really know. And he had dinner. And on the way out, he had a little doggy bag on the way out or whatever. And I had to wave at him. I says, fantastic. I mean, the man is in his mid-70s, if not more. And he looks like a boy of 21.
Just spriteful.
Unbelievable. And there Ronnie Wood was. And clearly, I at the end of the night... I said to the one of the owners, it's a Mason girl, and I don't know her name, and I should. I said, "My God, is he a regular?" I said, "Oh yes, at least once every 2 months we see Ronnie for dinner."
Oh my God!
So you never know where you're sitting in this absolutely restaurant in this little town in the middle of, you know, Kildare, and I'm going through Ireland, and we said, "Let's stop here." And every dish we got that night, it wasn't that it was you know, food in the right place leaves certain...
And the right people, with the right people. Yeah.
So I was eating with a very good friend. I was, you know, the little selection of things that came at the beginning was just very cool. Very kind of shared Tom Brown, Cornerstone-y kind of, you know, which was amazing, you know, really. And they're doing their own thing in their own environment. And that's what food is about.
Yeah.
It's finding that place where you feel happy at that moment with the right people, sharing with the right people. And that's what a restaurant is about. Rarely, I think, does a restaurant, you know, I think you go to a restaurant really to celebrate certain things, you know, to... So I just took a phone call there this morning and, you know, someone died last year and said, listen, Rich, you know, could we have a private room for this Friday for 20 people just for drinks? And I said, yeah, I'll do the canapés. I know the chap, he was a great customer of mine, James. You know, he was involved in Glastonbury and all that kind of alternative things and, you know, lived an amazing life. And I used to love him because he put on kind of a, he used to own the Rainbow Rooms in Finsbury Park and he put on Bob Marley and the Wailers in 77, wow. That great recording. It was owned by James, I can't even think of his second name, but he was a customer of mine for years.
Amazing.
And you know what I mean? I mean, someone put on Bob Marley and the Wailers in this theatre. You know, fantastic. So the stories you get from people above you are just wonderful and it inspires you to try and at least be half as good. And the people behind you, you know, you have to give a shout out to people like Albert Roux and, you know what I mean, really. I think, you know, he set a great thing in motion for so many chefs, really. And we're not putting anyone on a staple because, you know what I mean, he probably is a grumpy old fucker like us all, really. But the fact of the matter is, you know, he's a great dude. He's a great guy. He was very kind to me when I was very young. Mm-hmm. And he let me come work in his restaurant, you know, the Gavroche, when I was, I think, in my 20s. And they waived the fee you would have to pay in those years to work in the restaurant. And the people in that restaurant, Mark, Mr. Doherty was the head chef. Albert came in and said hello. And I thought it was, they made it so friendly and so wonderful that the restaurant that was number one probably in Europe and during that period, they were so sweet and so nice and so helpful and so encouraging. So, you know, people always sets the tone for your tone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, that's what we all must do.
Definitely.
It's great. Great.
I think on that note, we should do a little quick fire round to end it.
This is going to scare you.
Go on.
So we're going to rattle off a few short questions.
Who said I couldn't
talk
for Ireland?
I love it. This is, it makes us our job easy.
Right, whatever comes in your head, spit it out. You might have a story, you might just have, you know, short answers, whatever. Top three foods you can't live without.
Pork. Lovely salads from my garden and sep mushrooms.
Oh, that's a new one. That is a new
yeah.
One. Your favourite food guilty pleasure?
A Kit Kat and a big mug of tea. But not anymore because it has all changed. Old Kit Kats.
They got smaller.
They've got horrible. They've really, the chocolate is even less chocolate. As a matter of fact, they're now kind of even more sweeter than they were even 10 years ago. So honestly, I used to love a Kit Kat and a really big mug of tea. Breakfast, English breakfast tea and a Kit Kat. It was a great pick-me-up. And that was a guilty secret. But I have to say, it has changed. And but it was always a guilty secret to me.
Mm. Lovely.
Yeah.
Right, you've probably got a few of these, as all chefs do, but biggest kitchen disaster?
Oh, making a Christmas pudding mix as a youngster. Instead of putting 3 ounces of almonds into something, I put 3 pounds of almonds into it. I'll never live that one down, I have to tell you. I'll never live it down.
Bakewell pudding.
It was baked with Christmas pudding. I think we could have turned it into some class of an ice cream.
God. What's your three bits of kit you can't live without in the kitchen?
Oh, my. I've a couple of knives that have been with me from the very beginning. Definitely a good sharpening stone. Really good sharpening stone. And a good steel. Steel, a sharpening stone, my knife. That's it. Everything else you buy in, that's your gear. Because a blunt knife in a chef's hand is really, I mean, you really want to give him a slap in the air, wouldn't you?
I think it's a bit like footballers with shin pads. You know, when you hear like a footballer who's had shin pads since he was 7.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you had to eat the same meal every day, what would that meal be?
Good question. Same meal every day for my God.
The old rabbit on the bone.
Yeah, I think it would be a salad from my childhood garden, soft boiled egg, a runny in the middle, and sautéed rabbit on a cast iron pan on the bone.
If you cook that meal for anybody ever, who would it be?
Oh God, good question. Yeah, God, yeah, that's an interesting one. I love politics. And there's very few politicians that has really left a mark. I would, and it would have to be American, and Bobby Kennedy would have to, I would have loved to have shared a table with him and just talked on civil rights marches and the whole movement of putting the, him, you know, his brother dying and, you know, bringing that whole segregation thing in the States to a close at that time, to a certain close. I think fascinating, absolutely brave as anything, brilliant, focused, and died and assassinated far too young. Loved to have shared a table with them. Because that thing of the Cuban crisis and all of that whole Russian-American thing going on, Suez, you know, you could have, God, the information you could have gleaned from him, you know what I mean? Wow.
You have to make 7 courses for him.
Yeah, but make a, I mean, he probably doesn't even like food, like most politicians. They can't, you know what I mean?
I've got time to eat.
Eat with one hand and look at a screen with another, more than likely. But no, I think it was the last of those gentle, kind of gentleman politicians. And people like, you know what I mean, I'm not too sure on you know, the British front, you know, Clement Attlee and all of that, the founder of the NHS, I think would be incredible. But he might make great foodie customers, you know. But I think Bobby Kennedy lived in a time of kind of that kind of post-Second World War politics with the 70s, you know, that kind of, you know, Vietnam, all of that whole, a lot of stuff going on, big stuff. And of course, little stuff in the whole civil rights movement in the States and all of that. So yeah, Bobby Kennedy has to be one I'd love to share the job with.
Great. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you.
Thank you very much for letting us come in.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Yes Chef listeners. Oh my word, Richard Corrigan, a force of nature.
Mr. Hospitality.
Mr. Hospitality, I don't know if he liked that. Well, he did tell me he was going to stab me if I ever went for his bacon. What a guy. Thank you very much for listening. I mean, like, hopefully you enjoyed that as much as us. And he fed us. Don't tell anybody, he fed us. We had Chef's Table. Kieran was going to go, our producer, as soon as he heard Chef's Table. Like, through a turkey.
Never seen his pod boots move so fast.
I know, he's running in the pod boots. Listen, like, subscribe, get involved. We're having a cracking season so far, so share with your mates, and we'll see you next week.
Bon app.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.